From the ballroom of the Willard Hotel in Washington, the night session of a two-day meeting of Labor's Nonpartisan League, called by Major George L. Berry, Federal Coordinator for Industrial Cooperation and President of the League. The meeting is attended by chairman and executive board members of state organizations from all of the 48 states. Major Berry is presiding tonight and will introduce the speakers. Major Berry.
I wish the time permitted for me to engage in a lengthy introduction of one of America's leading progressives. I wish the time permitted for him to remake the magnificent address delivered to us this morning. But I feel it my duty and obligation to introduce him to you to the end that the greatest possible advantage may come from his splendid statesmanship founded upon the principle of liberalism. I present to you United States Senator Robert La Follette of Wisconsin, who will address you. President Berry, delegates to Labor's Nonpartisan League Conference, representatives of the farm organizations, and my fellow citizens. This meeting has been held on a very historic occasion. The Senate Judiciary Committee opens hearings this week on President Roosevelt's program of court reform. In this coming legislative struggle, the strength of popular democratic government in America will once more be pitted against the organized force of reaction. The same groups that fought the president so bitterly last fall in their vain attempt to regain their former political control over the federal government and to strengthen their economic power over the American people are fighting him on this issue of court reorganization. They were repudiated by an overwhelming majority of the people last November, but they have not surrendered. The lawyers who live off their Liberty League clients have come flying to the defense of their meal tickets, and their bar associations have been working overtime in organizing the attack upon the president's program. The newspapers have taken up the cry of dictator again, and the entire anti-New Deal propaganda machine is running night and day at full speed. In this hubbub, it is important that the will of the great silent masses of our citizens be not overlooked. When it comes to noise, the reactionaries can put on as good a demonstration as anyone, but the will of the American people is not expressed in noise. The Republicans found that out last November. I sincerely hope that Labor's Nonpartisan League will lend its influence and leadership on this occasion in pointing out just where the great mass of working men and women of this country stand in respect to President Roosevelt's program of judicial reform. Labor has made substantial progress in this country by means of political action, but every inch of the way is stubbornly challenged by the social philosophy of a day when strong social control of our economic system was thought by many to be unnecessary. In the past, the frontier offered an avenue of escape for the oppressed and unfortunate. The economic organization, the economic opportunities of an expanding nation with an abundance of natural resources were so great that they were in a very real sense available to almost everyone. There seemed to be enough wealth for everyone to use, steal, or exploit as he pleased without doing serious injury to his neighbors. Society was tolerant of property rights when everyone could enjoy them almost equally. But that day is past. The frontier is gone. When a man steals or exploits property rights today, he is sinning not only against nature and the principles of Christianity, but against his neighbor as well. This nation is no longer a loose-jointed, overgrown agricultural community made up of more or less self-sufficient, independent units. America in this day and age is a complex, interdependent society in which the production and distribution of real wealth is a very complicated business. The vast majority of the people today realize this. They know that a great deal of social control is absolutely necessary to keep the mechanisms of production and distribution working. But although the people who understand present-day problems realize this, the councils of the older generation, schooled in the thought of a bygone day, do not. I know that there are some men past the age of 70 who are mentally still young and vigorous, but they are the exception and not the rule. When a man passes that age, the chances are that he has lost the sympathetic understanding of the present time and the vital appreciation of its problems that is absolutely essential in the equipment of a judge. 6 of the justices of the United States Supreme Court are over 70 years of age, and 5 of them are very near or over 75. Not one of them is under the age of 60, yet the active work and struggle in this nation today is carried on by men and women between the ages of 20 and 60. Society generally recognizes the merit of retirement in old age. Nearly all of the faculties of our institutions of higher learning provide that their teacher shall be retired at the age of 60 or 65. And it is the common practice in industry today to retire their workers at the age of 40 or 45 and without pensions. There seems to be little objection to applying this principle and the common experience of society to the lower federal courts. Why not apply it to the Supreme Court? The answer is that there are some people who fear that to do so will change the temper of the court's opinion. I, for one, profoundly hope so. We want a court that is in touch with the problems of this present generation. Labor is not the only great group of American citizens that has a stake in securing greater understanding of present-day problems in the Supreme Court has witnessed the representatives of farm organizations who join with the representatives of labor in the deliberations of this conference now drawing to a close. Read for yourselves the majority and minority opinions of the present court on the problems which mean food, clothing, shelter, and happiness to the average man. And then I challenge you to say what the federal government can do within the limits of those decisions to solve these problems. The American people are not fundamentally interested in theories. They are interested in results. The collapse of democratic governments in other countries should serve as a warning to those who really believe in our form of government. These governments were discarded because they did not solve the problems of their people. Conscientious and intelligent statesmanship demands that we find ways and means to make our form of government work so that it can solve the problems of minimum wages, collective bargaining, social security, crop insurance, soil erosion, unemployment relief, public employment, housing, flood prevention, reforestation, the conservation of our natural resources as a base for the civilization of future generations, and the more equitable distribution of our annual income as it is produced from year to year. As long as a majority of the court stands athwart the will of the people and obstructs the working of democratic government, it is inviting the breakdown of our economic system and the destruction of our form of government by revolutionary changes. The stalling of our government on dead center by judicial fiat in recent years is not a defect in the Constitution. It is a defect in the Supreme Court. We do not need to amend the Constitution to free the processes of the democratic principle in this country. We simply need to amend a majority of the Supreme Court and its interpretation of the Constitution. In its exercise of the judicial veto, it has taken unto itself powers which it was never intended to have by the founders of our constitutional government. If Congress continues to yield to this false doctrine, it will betray the people into the hands of a judicial oligarchy governing for property rather than for humanity. President Roosevelt has proposed the only practical way in which Congress can secure from the Supreme Court a more sympathetic understanding of present-day problems and a greater appreciation of the purposes behind social legislation. It is a method entirely within the Constitution and definitely in keeping with the aims and spirit of democratic government. Those who wail that the President is proposing the execution of the independent judiciary forget to mention that every justice appointed to the court by the President Roosevelt under his proposal will have the same security and independence of tenure that a justice has now. This is not a struggle between the President and the court. It is a struggle between the representatives of the people responsible to them and a small group of justices who have lost touch with the problems of the people are not responsible to them for their tenure of office and have not the grace to step aside and let the present generation govern itself. These justices are the lame ducks of our judicial system. The question is simply whether a handful of judges ought to be allowed to exceed their lawful authority by paying more attention to their personal, economic, and social beliefs than to the Constitution itself. The issue is between special vested interests, dodging behind an economic theory of days gone by on the one hand, and the will of the people to govern themselves on the other. When a judge sets himself squarely athwart the people's path to progress, it is time for the true defenders of democracy to take action. Do not be fooled by the crocodile tears shed by these reactionary defenders of a backward court in the name of civil liberty. I am as concerned about the civil and religious liberties of our people as any man in the United States. I know what it means to fight for lost causes. My father fought many of them, and I know what it cost him. I have fought for many myself, some bitterly and passionately unpopular. No kind of legal guarantee is more than a scrap of paper in the chaos produced by the breakdown of an economic system. Our civil liberties in this country will be preserved so long as we keep our people satisfied with a democratic system of government which allows and fosters civil liberties, but no longer. Those who hold our civil liberties dear should rally to the support of the president's proposal and thus preserve the fundamental principle of democratic self-government. There are a number of men in Congress who propose to settle this issue of judicial usurpation by constitutional amendment. Some of them are sincere but misguided liberals. But the real support behind the movement for a constitutional amendment as the way to meet this present issue is coming from the reactionaries who were beaten at the polls last November. They know only too well that constitutional amendment is a long and a slow process. They know that 13 states are sufficient to defeat any such effort. The reactionaries know, too, that by working on the 13 smallest states in the Union, they can block the will of the entire nation with the votes of only 10% of the people. Is that democracy? The reactionaries know, if some of our liberals do not, why the child labor amendment is still wandering in the wilderness of constitutional ratification after 13 long, weary years. And they also know that even if the amendment does become a part of the Constitution, a reactionary majority on the court can be relied upon to pervert its true intent by the use of this process known as judicial interpretation. Our task at the present time is to make sure that the voice of the masses of the people on the farms, in the factories, and in the small businesses of America is not lost in the tumult raised by organized and well-financed minorities. Special interests are protesting to Congress against President Roosevelt's plan for judicial reorganization. They come with the hands of Jacob, but the voice of Esau. They claim to represent the sentiment of the people, but be not deceived. We must not confuse noise and activity with numbers. The special interests are both very noisy and exceedingly active, but the people have the numbers, and the people want to control their own government. With the active support of the farmers, wage earners, and small businessmen, this historic struggle to restore control of this government to the people will be won at this session of Congress.
One of the oldest and one of the greatest international labor unions in this country is that of the International Typographical Union. We have here their president, Mr. Charles P. Howard, one of our country's greatest labor leaders, and I now present him to you.
Mr. Chairman, members of Labor's Nonpartisan League, I shall endeavor to discuss the Supreme Court issue from the practical side. The proposal to reform the federal judiciary has become an issue which will vitally affect the welfare of a vast majority of the people of the United States. Not since the famous Dred Scott decision, which ultimately resulted in the Civil War, have the people been confronted with such a momentous issue. It is not to be considered that we who support the President's program are attacking the Supreme Court. It is rather an attack upon a system which the Supreme Court has fostered by its decisions. A system which now menaces our democracy. I am not speaking to you as a lawyer. I am just one of those Americans whose ancestors fought in the Revolutionary War to give birth to a nation wherein every citizen can worship God according to the dictates of his own conscience and enjoy life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness as an inalienable right. But few of those engaged in this campaign to spread fear that the people are about to be deprived of some of their liberties have expressed opposition to that portion of the President's program which has to do with the United States District and Circuit Courts of Appeal. The effort to perpetuate outgrown interpretations of the Constitution. Those who bitterly opposed re-election of the president have retired behind the bulwark of the Supreme Court. As the Supreme Court has the last word in telling the people what their representatives and senators in Congress cannot do, the spokesmen for privilege and special interests appear to be content if they can retain control of this citadel of reaction. Now, what has the President proposed should be done about the Supreme Court? He has not suggested that the court be abolished. The Constitution says there shall be one Supreme Court. He has not said the powers of the Supreme Court should be limited or restricted. He proposes that under certain specified conditions, as many as 15 Supreme Justices shall exercise the enormous powers vested in and exercised by the Supreme Court instead of that power residing in 9 Supreme Justices. In a nation where the fundamentals of democracy are universally accepted, it is not centralization of power to have a majority of 15 justices instead of having a majority of 9 pass upon the constitutionality of laws which affect the rights and welfare of all the people. He has not proposed limitation of the tenure of office for Supreme Court justices. The Constitution provides they may continue in office during good behavior, which has been interpreted to mean for the period of natural life. The President's program does not contemplate a Supreme Court of 15 under all conditions. It proposes the president may appoint one justice for each member of the court who continues to wear his judicial robe after having reached the age of 70 years. The plan permits retention of justices who may have acquired wisdom as a result of experience, but permits addition of younger men who have been more closely in touch with the trend of national, industrial, and economic requirements. Some leading opponents base their opposition upon the charge that the proposal is not in accordance with the Constitution. The record furnishes complete refutation of such an illogical contention. The Constitution requires the President shall recommend to the Congress such legislation as he deems necessary to promote the general welfare of the people. The authority of the Congress to fix the number of justices on the Supreme Bench is beyond question. 6 times since the Constitution was ratified, Congress has exercised its right to increase and decrease the number of Supreme Court justices. And never once previously has the authority of the Congress been questioned. Where then is there any logic in the charge the president has acted improperly or exceeded his constitutional duty in this instance? The indictment most generally made by opponents is that the president is attempting to establish dictatorial control by packing the court. Such a charge ignores the fact the president can only nominate Supreme Court justices, and his nominees must be confirmed by a majority of the Senate before they can don the judicial robe. Do those senators who oppose the proposal have so little faith in the Senate they believe a majority would at any time permit the president to pack the Supreme Court? Or do they believe his appointees would constitute more of a menace to the people's liberties than have the appointees of other presidents? Or do they believe a Supreme Court that would not nullify every progressive law enacted by Congress would endanger the liberties of the people and the industrial and economic welfare of the nation? Those who make such a charge must assume that legislation inimical to the general welfare would be supported by a majority of the Congress, approved by the Supreme Court, and then approved by the House of Representatives, the President, the Senate, and then affirmed by the Supreme Court. Does history record the Supreme Court was packed when Andrew Jackson appointed 5 justices, which constituted a majority? Did Abraham Lincoln pack the Supreme Court when he named 5 justices, also a majority? Was William Howard Taft charged with packing the court when he appointed 6 of the 9 justices? The answer is no. The record speaks for itself. The workers want protection of progressive legislation, and they want the uncertainty of nullifying court decisions removed. They want reform, and they want it now. The millions of wage earners, who cannot afford to send telegrams to congressmen and senators and are too busy trying to secure the necessities of life to write letters, are as nearly unanimous in support of the president's program as they were for his re-election last November. A Supreme Court which uses legalistic language as an excuse for nullifying a law which would prevent the practices of grinding the lives of children into corporation profits needs reforming, and a procedure that requires 13 years to secure approval of only 28 states of the 36 required to outlaw such a practice is too slow a procedure. Labor is supporting the president.
Ladies and gentlemen, you just heard an address by Mr. Charles P. Howard, president of the Typographical Union of America. Previously, you heard United States Senator Robert M. La Follette of Wisconsin addressing this night session of a 2-day meeting of Labor's Nonpartisan League. The speakers were introduced by Major George L. Berry, President of the League.